The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Amateur Traveler, episode 567. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about fairy pools and locks, standing stones, cliffs, and crofting as we go to the Hebrides in Scotland. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. I hope you're having a good vacation this year, if it is summer where you are, or winter, depending on which hemisphere or when you're listening to this. If you haven't got plans for vacation this year, don't forget about our trip to India in the fall. But for now, let's talk about Scotland. I'd like to welcome to the show Matt Higgs from milesbyfoot.com, who's come to talk to us about the Hebrides. Matt, welcome to the show.
Hi, Chris. I'm so glad to be here today.
And we say the Hebrides. Let's put it on a map before we start talking too much about it.
So we're talking today about Scotland, and particularly the UK's. Scotland being the northernmost country on the main island of Britain. The Hebrides that we're actually talking about today are to the north and west of the main island. You're talking quite a distance even from some of the main cities of Scotland that you think about, Glasgow and Edinburgh. There's still a considerable distance from there to the Hebrides. These are going to be the Western Islands. That's what they used to call them, the Western Isles. There's lots of different islands there along the west coast that some of them are related to one another, both culturally and geologically. They kind of call that whole section the Hebrides. It's still part of what they call the Highlands in Scotland, but it is distinct in the fact that it's just the islands are what they call the Hebrides.
Well, and I have to wonder, since recording this in 2017 in July, whether when somebody is listening to this in the future, they're going to think of the fact of Scotland being in the United Kingdom as quaint or not. We shall see.
That's right.
How that all works out. And why should somebody go to the Hebrides?
Well, the Hebrides are great because they offer a really great opportunity for someone who likes to get away from it all, but it's actually pretty accessible. There are lots of ways to get up there. I know that many of the folks that you've brought on your show, they have great stories of going long distances to get away from trials and toils of everyday life. But the Hebrides are actually fairly accessible for all the listeners on your show, whether they're in Europe or in the States. It's actually pretty easy to get there, but it's still very remote, very natural. There's not a lot there. There's also a whole bunch of history ranging back all the way back to prehistoric times, all the way up to relatively recently. And you can kind of see those different phases all over the Hebrides, depending on if you know where to look. One thing that I love about Scotland in general, but especially in the Hebrides, is how much hands-on opportunity there is. There's not a lot between you and the history. So you can walk right up to the ruins. There's no barrier. You can step inside them. You can look at the walls, look at the bricks, look at where they used to cook their meals. And it's very easy to see it. And there's just nothing between you. There's no pretense, I guess. You can learn some history, but you can also kind of create a fantasy in your head about what would have happened if I had lived in this house, if I had lived against this wall, all these different kinds of things. Of course, the Hebrides, and specifically the Isle of Skye, which is probably the most famous island in the Hebrides, are known for their beauty and their hiking. There's all sorts of different kinds of terrain that you can walk in the Hebrides. If you like to walk through mountains, if you like to walk through forests, if you like to walk through open spaces, if you like to walk through swamps, there's something kind of for everybody when it comes to being out in the nature itself. It's easy to do. I think probably the last thing that I'd say is really is a big draw is you can go there with your family, you can go there as a couple, and you can go there independently. It's all about if those things interest you, if that kind of history, if that kind of remoteness, if all those things kind of interest you, if being surprised by the way that the weather is, and you know, Scotland is, of course, known for its wild weather. But if that's something that interests you and your loved ones, then it's something that you can do, or you can go by yourself. And at least this most recent time, I did that for half of my trip.
Okay. And we're going to get, obviously, into more detail here as we move in. We should also say, though, we did just recently, within the last, I want to say 6 months, do an episode on Scotland that went up into the Highlands and did include the Isle of Skye. So we're probably going to cover some of that, but then we're going to push on into the areas we did not cover on that show.
Wonderful.
That being said, you said it was easy to get to. Are we getting there by ferry or are we flying in?
The best way that I would tell someone to get to the Hebrides really is that you're going to fly into one of the two major cities in Scotland, which would be either Glasgow or Edinburgh, if you're coming from the States, as I would have. So you can fly into either location, and there are actually some excellent intercity buses that run around Scotland that can get you both from the large cities to the other large cities, but they stop at lots of places in between. They're very manageable. If you land in Glasgow, for example, which is what I did, Glasgow and Edinburgh are quite close, only about 45 minutes to an hour by either train or car apart from each other. They're quite close. And so it's whatever is convenient based on the airline, whichever airline that you utilize. But I flew into Glasgow, and from Glasgow to the Isle of Skye is roughly by car about 4.5 hours, I would say, if you don't really stop anywhere. And then by bus, it's about 5.5. So it's not a big difference. It's not like the bus stops for an inordinate amount of time or anything. You do get a couple stops. So it's not like you're sitting on a bus for 6 hours without a chance to stretch your legs.
And then getting from there to the Outer Hebrides, is that the right term or what's the...
Well, the Outer Hebrides would be Lewis and Harris.
Yep.
North Uist. But I only went to Lewis and Harris. If you look at a map, you'll see kind of a ring, like a wall along the northwest part of Scotland. And those islands that kind of look like they're in a line, that's the Outer Hebrides. The Inner Hebrides would include Skye, the Isle of Mull, the Small Isles, they call them, but it's four different small islands that are just south of Skye. If you wanted to get directly to the Outer Hebrides, which would be Lewis and Harris, Uist and all them, you can take a plane to get there. Lewis and Harris, geologically, they're one island, but they're so different from each other that they actually do call the north part Lewis and the south part Harris. There is one airport on Lewis and Harris that you can fly into. It's a short, inexpensive flight. They fly several a day. If you're mostly interested in getting to Lewis and Harris, you can fly there as well. If you were to drive, you would basically drive to Skye. You would get to the town of Uig, which is in the northwest part of Skye, and you would take a ferry from Uig over to Tarbert. Tarbert is right in between
Lewis and Harris.
Lewis and Harris, right. It's kind of right where they merge, pretty close anyway. So you would take that ferry, and that's about an hour and 45 minutes, I think it was. It would take you about 8 hours if you were to drive it, or an hour to fly to Stornoway, which is the main town.
Given the distances, that must be a fast boat ferry? Catamaran or something?
The one from Uig to Tarbert is pretty large, and it was pretty fast. Mm-hmm. You're looking at about...
It's not as far as I thought. Okay, it's only about 30 miles or something. Okay, yeah.
You're tootling right along, and you're in a pretty big boat, so for those people who are worried about ferries getting sick, you're not going to get sick. This is a large boat, so you're not going to get tossed around. It is very manageable. The only disadvantage I'd say to doing that is that the ferries are fairly infrequent. It's a big boat. They take pretty much everything that's going with them. So lots and lots of cars. It's one or two a day usually. And so if you miss it, you're going to have to stay on Skye, darn it, for a day.
Where are we starting and what are we doing? Let's begin at the beginning of our itinerary here.
So if you wanted to see Skye and you wanted to see Lewis and Harris, you could do it in a week. It's very manageable.
Okay.
Basically, what you would want to do is once you land in Glasgow, you'll want to finish your traveling to the Hebrides that same day. So thankfully, most of the flights that come into Europe, as some of the listeners might know, they land fairly early in the morning, and then you can take a bus later in that morning, or if you're driving, of course, you can do that and actually get up to Skye that same day. That's what I did this time. So on your day two, you're getting up to the Hebrides, that first full day that you actually have in Scotland. What I would recommend is if you're going to spend some time on Skye, the main touristy feeling attraction is probably the fairy pools of Glenbrittle.
Mm-hmm.
I think her name was Sarah, the previous person that brought up Scotland. She had talked about the fairy pools. Definitely worth a visit. They're fairly accessible, even if you're not a big hiker. You basically park at a car park and you go down a little path. You can go as long as you want, but you could do it in an hour. But the fairy pools are really nice because you, especially after a nice rain, they're nice and babbling, and you have the beautiful Coolin Mountains behind it. That's probably what Skye is most known for from a hiking and venturing perspective, is the Coolin, which is a big ridge of, well, there's two different ridges that are called the Coolin, but they're just big, striking mountains. They're not particularly tall, but because they're so dramatic that you're going up 3,000 feet in a very short distance, and so they're very epic looking, I guess I would say. And so you have that as a backdrop as you kind of go through the fairy pools, and it's a very simple hike, very relaxed hike, but you can do that. And that's probably, I would say, the main attraction for folks that aren't going to hike on the Kulin or going to hike on the Kerang, which is in the northern part of Skye.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I might recommend for that very first day. If you look at a map of Skye, it looks kind of like a kidney bean. You've got a bend along the south, and then it goes north. So it's kind of an L shape, but right at the center of that kidney bean is a town called Sligachan. You can lodge there. There's a couple of different places you can stay there, but from there you can either drive or walk to the ferry pools, and I walk. So you can walk across the hills, and it's a beautiful walk. I did it when I got there, and so I walked from there about 8 miles to the end of Glenbrittle, where I had a hostel that I was staying. You'll get some beautiful views along the way. You're very isolated in Skye. Even in high season, you know, you're not going to be surrounded by tourists bumping into everybody. I know that sometimes for hikers here, you know, if they go on the Appalachian Trail or something like that during peak season, you actually, even along that huge trail, you'll see a bunch of people. That's not really the case on Skye, even at a high season.
Okay.
Portree, which is the largest town on Skye, is a really nice little diversion. You can stay there as well. But one thing that I did this time as well, if someone's feeling a little more adventurous, but maybe they don't want to go up and down in the Kulin, is they can go do what's called Ruan Dunan. So if you're looking again at a map of Skye, it's the very southwest corner of it. There's a Rua. Rua is the Gaelic word for like a headland or a point.
Mm-hmm.
There are ruins there because it used to be a clan stronghold for, I think it was Clan MacLeod. Most folks, when they think of Scotland, they think of clans. And Skye was, over the course of its history, dominated by about three different clans in different sections. Basically, the idea of Ruan Dunan is when they would go out there, you would have the sea at your back, and then they actually built a wall, which I had no idea when I walked out there myself. I don't know if you'll cut this, but basically when I went over there, I was doing research for a book that my mom is writing. And so I wanted to go and see what it was like to stand in those ruins. And you're quite isolated. They actually have a sign right when you walk out that says, like, make sure you know what you're doing, because there's no one that's going to come help you. They have that right as you go out onto the Rua. The whole walk is about 6 to 7 miles round trip, but it does take a while. I think one thing that might be important for some listeners to take into account if you're a big hiker is a lot of times when you think about hiking, you think maybe 2 miles an hour. You're thinking, oh yeah, it's a 10-mile walk. It'll take about 5 hours. Well, a 10-mile walk in Skye can really take you all day, depending on the weather, depending on how windy it is. You know, that can make it so that you can't really move with the same speed that you would if it's really boggy. That can slow you down. But that's something that I would recommend to do on Skye would be Ruan Dunan.
And I'm going to interrupt you here for a second and say you were helping research your mother's book.
Yes, I sure was.
What kind of book is your mother writing?
Well, she has written several different books on Scotland, and this new one, I don't want to give too much of it away. I'm just not sure what she's allowed
fiction
to share.
Fiction or nonfiction?
About it. It is a fiction.
Okay. So a historical fiction is what you were helping?
Yeah, I was helping her with the historical fiction. She's written several of that are set in the lowlands of Scotland, but never one up here in the highlands.
Okay.
I've heard of lots of folks that have gone to Skye, and so they've gone to those key locations. They've been to the fairy pools. They've been to the Kulin. They've been to the Old Man of Storr, which I guess I can take a moment and talk about here. So I'd mentioned Portree, and Portree is the capital, if you will, of Skye. It's still a fairly small town, but it's the biggest town for miles in any direction. So it has all those amenities that you would expect from a larger town. It has a couple groceries. It has several restaurants and bars. It has several hotels, some really nice hotels, in fact. It's got a nice harbor there. But there's lots to do in Skye, and Portree is a good place to kind of make your base. There's several hostels there as well. So whether you are there on a shoestring or you're there, you want to stay in the fanciest royal hotel that you can, all those options are in Portree. It's kind of centralized relatively. From there, you can go to the Old Man of Storr, which is another thing that Skye is famous for. They call it the Old Man of Storr because it's a pinnacle that's up on a bit of a rise, well, a considerable rise, I guess. And it looks kind of like an old man. So as you're driving towards the Old Man of Storr, you can see it from miles away. And it's just what looks like you'll see kind of the cliff sloping up from the west. And then you'll see the cliff on the other side. And then you'll see a little bump. You'll see like what looks like a person from a distance. And you can climb up there. And many, many people do that as well. They'll go up. And it's a pretty considerable hike. That one is a little more strenuous. I did it last year. I was in Scotland in 2016 as well, only on Skye and Rossay. And I did the Old Man of Storr last year. And it's certainly a beautiful view as you get up there. You can turn around and there's a beautiful lake that kind of stretches out. If it catches the light, you can really see for quite a ways across the Sound of Rossay itself. So Those are probably the two big things that people come to Skye to see the fairy pools, see the Old Man of Store. But one thing that I really like about Skye, and more accurately, Rasse is an island right off the coast of Skye. All that you do is, if you're in Sligachan, it's just 2 or 3 miles up the road. If you're from Portree, it's about 8 miles. There are buses that go there. And you can actually take a ferry from Skye to this island of Rasse. Now, Rasse itself is a fairly large island. It's about the size of Manhattan, but it only has about 100 residents. So it's almost 99.9% either open country, or in many cases, it actually contains ruins of crofting villages. So in the relatively recent history of Scotland, there was a period of time called the crofting period, where basically it was almost, you know, this was actually kind of after the whole idea of Scottish independence had kind of faded away, and the UK just in general, you know, so England and everyone else, Scotland was kind of being assimilated. And so what they did was they basically let the landowners that lived there kind of live there, but basically they still had to pay a rent. So it was almost a form of feudalism. Basically, these crofting villages, these tiny little villages that were self-supporting, they existed all over the Highlands. And in anywhere between about the turn of the 20th century until maybe the 1930s or 40s, many of these villages were still inhabited, still functioned much as they did hundreds of years earlier, but the vast majority of them eventually became depleted. People moved away.
Okay, hang on. Before we let people move away, What is a croft and what was the point of the villages?
Sure. So they were farming villages.
Okay, but what was the point of having the farming village here? Why is it related to the movement for Scottish independence or not? Or
so basically the way that it used to be was that you basically had clan lands and you were pretty much free to do what you wanted to. The clans were sovereign for all intents and purposes.
Sure.
Even though technically, nominally, they were still under the crown, the clans pretty much ruled the roost. Mm-hmm. But then as the whole idea of clan politics kind of descended a little bit, as the UK itself, when they became a dual country and there wasn't really a fight for independence, then that kind of idea where clans ruled everything and you could kind of do as you please at the pleasure of the clan, that kind of disappeared. And so everyone had to answer to the governor from the crowns. Mm-hmm. So these crofts were a way to organize these individuals, these farmers. They didn't get to keep everything they made anymore. A portion of it had to go to the crown.
So it's a tenant farming system under the crown.
Yes, right.
Okay, got it.
It's kind of unique to the Highlands.
Okay. You started to say, and then people were moving away.
That's right. And so what happened was when people started to move away about 100 years ago or so, they just moved. And so the remnants of these crofting villages, you can find them all over the Hebrides. And in particular on Rasse, you can see several. Rasse used to be bustling with 400 people, but basically these villages were spread all over and they were not particularly large. You know, 20 to 25 people would live there. But when they got up and left, they left their houses. And last year when I was on Rasse, I was taking one of the walks that had been recommended to me by the place I was staying, and I came across one of these crofting villages called Halleg on the east side of Rasse, and I had no idea it was going to be there. And as I say, that's kind of what I was saying, you know, it's like this whole no pretense, you know, you'll just come across, oh, here's this ruin that has no signs pointing toward it or anything like that. And so I came across this village and it was eerie. I had no idea it was there, but you had all these old houses. Could see the little central square where everybody was, and this beautiful picturesque place for a village that just didn't really work anymore for these people. I guess that the reason would be that they couldn't make enough off of the sheep, or they literally went out to greener pastures. They found somewhere better to live, and so they abandoned these villages. But you can find these villages all over Rasse especially, but also on Skye and in Lewis and Harris. You can find these little pockets of these houses.
Okay.
There was another thing that occurred back in the late 1700s called the clearances that I guess you could argue that it was a bit of revenge. England and the United Kingdom just in general came and swept people away from their ancestral homes. That was the thing about Skye and anywhere else, because they were clan lands, people lived there their whole lives. And so when they drove them away, it wasn't just, hey, come move somewhere else. They were displacing them from their ancestral home. And so for those places that weren't then populated by crofters, you have still more ruins that you'll come across, and they're clearance ruins as opposed to crofting ruins. These are much older, 1700s, 1800s. The clearances was a way for the crown to redistribute where people were and break up those potential for clan resurgence, et cetera. You'll find that all over Sky. And I think it's one of the things that makes it not only charming, but also unique. One of the other things that a lot of hikers do is they'll walk along the Kerrang. The Kerrang is in the northern part of Sky, and it's the largest landslip in the UK. It's basically where one plate comes across another. And so you have basically these sheer cliffs, and then it looks like, you know, just if you were to push two pieces of cardstock over one another, so one part will pop up a little bit, and that's what it looks like. That's a very common place for people to walk as well. But let's go on and head to the Outer Hebrides. As I know that you had said that Sarah had covered some of that, and I think, honestly, most of the other stuff I thought about mentioning, I think she pretty much did cover it. So let's head over to the Outer Hebrides. So to do that, you'll be taking a ferry. Mm-hmm. If you're staying in Portree or you're staying in Sligachan, either one, you can drive to a little town called Uig, and it's spelled U-I-G, but that's how they say it, is Uig. There's a ferry there that leaves, depending on what time of year you go, it'll leave either once or twice a day, and then there's some days where it doesn't go at all. So it's important to check the ferry schedule, make sure you have a good idea before you actually get on the ferry, especially if you're bringing a car with you. One thing that I should say is if you do go to Skye, as I did, where I didn't have a car, I took a bus, it's very easy to get around. All that you need is a good handle on the bus schedule, and you actually can get most anywhere you need to. That's not really the case as much on Lewis and Harris. There are not as many buses. It's a little harder to get around. So if you have the option to get a car once you're on Lewis and Harris, I might recommend it. It's going to make things a lot easier for you and much more flexible. But I say that because if you do have a car when you're in Skye, I might recommend booking that ferry ahead of time. Mm-hmm. You can go on to the CalMac. That's the company that runs all the ferries in the Outer Hebrides, calmac.co.uk, and you can reserve a ticket for yourself if you have a vehicle. And I would recommend it. The ferry is plenty large, but it's also the only way to get there. So it's going to be pretty busy. Once you're in the Outer Hebrides, about an hour, 45-minute ferry, as long as the weather's cooperating, then you'll get over to Lewis and Harris. And where you'll land is Tarbet, which is this cute little village. It's one of the biggest things on the island. You're not going to find lots of large towns on Lewis and Harris. Stornoway is the largest town in the Hebrides, and it's about 8,000 people. So it's not particularly large. It has everything you need, for sure. But Lewis and Harris is just not a very high population. The entire Hebrides, the inner and outer, so Skye and all the inner islands and the outer islands, population, I want to say, is about 30,000. So none of these places is going to be particularly populated, but that's part of its charm. You know, you'll come across towns that have three houses. And that's, at least in my opinion, one of the big draws is, you know, you can really kind of feel the nature around it and that humanity in general has had a fairly low impact so that you're able to look out at these beautiful landscapes of mountains and play of the clouds and all that kind of stuff. You can see that without a lot of interference from human activity.
Okay. What are we going to do once we're out there? We're in Tarbert.
There's lots of things for you to do, of course, but none of the roads on Lewis and Harris are particularly high speed. And so just like with walking, you might think it's 60 miles away. It'll take me an hour to get there because at least in the U.S., that's true in most instances. But if you're going to drive 60 miles, that's pretty much your day. Lewis as an island, you know, as I say, you know, Lewis is pretty large if you're looking at a map.
Lewis is the northern part and Harris is the southern part? Okay.
Harris is kind of square shaped and then Lewis is kind of cone shaped. And so Lewis is considerably larger than Harris. And the fun thing about Lewis and Harris is even though you may not know, let's say that you'd missed the sign that says, welcome to Lewis, welcome to Harris, you can tell pretty quickly just because the landscapes are so different. So in Lewis, Lewis is fairly flat, rolling hills, kind of like what you'd see in the lowlands, you know, the whole area around Glasgow and Edinburgh. But once you get to Harris, that's quite mountainous. It's much like the Coolin. It's very sharp mountains. You can easily tell once you've crossed over. It feels very foreign. So for folks that have been to Scotland before, you might think of the whole Lassie and Tam O'Shanter and all that kind of stuff that you think of as Scottish, you know, bagpipes and that kind of thing. That's really all kind of in the lowlands. Once you get up into the highlands, you actually can encounter an entirely different culture. And you'll see it as soon as you get to Skye that basically every place name is no longer in English, it's in Gaelic. And when I say Gaelic, that's Scottish Gaelic. Mm-hmm. It and Irish are related to one another, but they say Gaelic to distinguish the two. But basically, once you're on Lewis and Harris, pretty much every sign is in Gaelic only. you might see some English, and admittedly, even if it's in Gaelic, if it's a place name, you probably can tell what it is. Lewis and Harris, as well as Skye to a lesser degree, have a lot of influence both from the native Gaelics, but also from the Norse. And so the Norse kind of moved in during the 7th and 8th centuries, and really there until about the end of the 13th century. And so there's a lot of influence there too. And as such, you can see a lot of Norse sites, if that's kind of an interest to you.
Well, let's get specific. So I'm in Tarbert. Mm-hmm. Where should I go first?
Once you get to Tarbert, mm-hmm. usually the ferry is about the middle of the day. And so you'll have the rest of the day to kind of explore. And what I might recommend for that first day is to go up to Lewis and see probably the most famous location on Lewis and Harris, which is the Callanish stones.
Okay.
It's these very straight, upright stones, not as broad as something like Stonehenge or something like that, but these single stones that are standing in a circle. It's free to go in. There is a nice little visitor center there that actually does have a little exhibit that you can walk through, which I do recommend. It's a nominal fee. But then you can actually go out onto the area where there's stones. So the Callanish stones are quite long. It's about an acre worth of property that you're walking along to see all these different stones. Mm-hmm. The stones are quite old. They're about 5,000 years old, and they actually were only discovered within the last couple hundred years because Lewis and Harris is covered in peat. It was actually buried under several feet of peat. And so as they kind of dug out peat for fuel and other things like that, mm-hmm. they found these stones and excavated the entire complex. But it's a really neat experience, especially if you've never been to Standing Stones before. And personally, at least for me, I love Standing Stones. There's just so much mystery in them that I think is so attractive that makes you speculate about all these things, especially Callanish. It's older than Stonehenge, I believe. Hmm. There's even more mystery, you know, at least with Stonehenge. Maybe they have an idea that it was a calendar. Maybe they have an idea it was religious in that respect. But the Callanish stones, they really don't know. Obviously, it would have taken them great effort to do that. So that's the big site on Lewis and Harris. And it's still not touristy. And I think that's what I like about it. Yeah, they have a little cafe there.
And it looks like the dates on these are roughly 2900 to 2600 BC. So we're talking about something nearly 5,000 years old at this point.
That's right. Yeah. So they're very old. You know, they have some parking there for tour buses. And chances are that if someone's going to Lewis and Harris, they're going to go to mm-hmm. the Callanish Stones. What I might recommend if you're up that direction is also a place called Duncarloway. Not that far from the Callanish Stones. It's probably about a 15 to 20 minute drive from there. About 7 miles, I'd say, would be Duncarloway. Duncarloway is what's called a broch. So, you know, you think about Scotland, you think about castles. But before there were castles, there were brochs. And brochs are basically Iron Age fortified structures. So we're talking quite old, Romans and before. So this would have been 2,000 years old. And Duncarloway is about that. It's, I think, 100 AD was what they told me. They're basically these conical structures. They're stone, and they were put in a defensible place so that you could ward off attackers, etc. But it was kind of like a keep of a castle. So it had all mm-hmm. of those essential things within it. It had a place to cook food. It had a place to make clothing. It had a place to store stuff. It had a place to sleep. It had all those different things, but it was conical in shape. And so you had two or three different levels. The inside walls were concentric so that you could actually walk up. That's where the staircases were. Mm-hmm. And then they put down different floors with timbers and everything like that. At least at Duncarloway, there was also a very charming little visitor center that kind of explained it. So even if you just kind of were passing by and you didn't know a thing about it, it's definitely worth stopping at. But you can go up. It's still largely intact. This is one of the best examples of a surviving broch in Scotland. Hmm. The Hebrides, not going to be as interesting for someone who's not into history and into, you know, that kind of wild nature that is so definitive of the Hebrides.
Okay. Where to next?
Those are the big targets that I would say on Lewis. Once we get to Harris, though, let's go back that direction to Harris on perhaps another day. So if you're going down to Harris, there's a couple things that will really stand out to you. If you're going along the coast, which is where the road goes, you will encounter white sand beaches like you would have never expected to run into in Scotland, of all places. You could have plucked these right out of the Caribbean, would have made total sense. There's beautiful white sand beaches on the western coast of Harris. Mm-hmm. I was actually with my mother at the time, and she and I were both floored. She had read that there had been something like that, but when we came over the rise and looked over, and there it was, blue ocean with white sands all along, probably not nearly as inviting it was probably fairly mushy to walk on. It's not like I would actually recommend going out and walking on it, at least not up to the water, because it might be pretty treacherous. But it's beautiful to look at. And so you can stop there. There are lots of places along the side of the road where you can stop. But as you go along the west coast of Harris, you'll follow these white beaches the whole time. And so you can kind of stop where you like to. Oh, look, there's a ruin. Oh, look, there's a standing stone that you want to get out of your car and go look at. You sure can. They have so many ruins that they kind of stopped naming them. That's what's kind of beautiful is you'll have farmers that their cows graze right next to a 1,000-year-old ruin. No big deal. That's just kind of how it is there. So again, Harris is kind of a square shape. So you'll start at the northeast corner. And if you make your way around, there is a place, and my mother actually told me about this, so I don't have any personal experience, but there's a guy that lives on the southwest coast of Harris that he runs a place. It's like the Shalom Temple or something like that, but it's not actually religious at all.
Okay.
Basically, what he does, though, is he is the record keeper of note of Harris. She actually was going to set her book on Harris, and so she visited with the guy there, and it was a fount of knowledge. And so at the temple, for everyone else that comes, there's lots of information about Harris. If you see a ruin and you want to know more about it, or you see a particular landscape that, wow, there must have been something cool that happened there, chances are you're going to find information about it there on that west coast of Harris. The place that he keeps has all sorts of information. If the kind of history about the medieval Celtic tribes that would have lived out there, if that's interesting, then I would recommend stopping there. You can't miss the signs.
It looks like the sign we're looking for is the Shalom Visitor Center, S-E-A-L-L-A-M, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes.
Perfect. All right. So if you're continuing along the coast there, you'll get to the town at the southern end of Harris. It's called Leverburgh. So it's L-E-V-E-R-B-U-R-G-H. And just like you say, Edinburgh, it's Leverburgh. So Leverburgh is important because it's the place that we'll set off to go to St. Kilda, but we'll come back to that later.
Okay.
If you keep going past Leverburgh, there's one last place on Harris that I'd recommend that you see, and it's called Rodel. It's spelled R-O-D-E-L, and it's a little tiny town, but it's home to a place called St. Clement's Church, and it's this really cool church that you can actually see from about 2 miles away. As you go from Leverburgh to Rodel, you actually go through a little valley, and you can't miss the church. You'll see it from a long distance off, even though the church is actually quite small, but it's the only thing of any prominence. When we were driving down that, I pictured those people who lived on Harris as they were going to church. They would see the church from miles away, so it'd be easy to know they were going the right direction. It's from about the 14th, 15th century. It was actually destroyed in a fire a couple hundred years later, and then it was recently, you know, I say in quotes, it was recently restored by a rich countess from the island back in the 1870s. And so you can kind of see what the church looked like back in the 15th century when it would have been most busy. But it's a very simple church. You're not going to Notre Dame in Paris. You're not going to Westminster Abbey, but you get to see this place of worship for the people that would have lived there. So Lewis and Harris were Christianized, much like the rest of Scotland, in the 800 or 900s. And of course, they would have contended a bit with the Norse belief system that would have come across. But there were still many Christians all over Lewis and Harris and all of the Hebrides, you know, up through the previous millennium. So a church would have been very practical. And so it's a very simple church, but it's very picturesque. I think that's probably the best word for it. It's set along a cliffside right up to the water. We were reading a little bit about it later. What we found was that most people who attended the church would have gotten there by water, not by land. When you get there and you can see that there's a little bit of a natural harbor and there's still sheep everywhere. If it was a beautiful day, there were gravestones there, of course. Some of them were relatively recent, World War I, World War II, and then some of them were so old that the actual dates had been worn off. It's now just historical. It's not used anymore as an actual place of worship. There's no cost or anything. You can walk right up to it. And this would have been the edge of the world for Brits and Scots both. The Western Islands was the island past the end of the world, which they would have considered a sky. So Lewis and Harris was really quite insular. I think it's about half of Lewis and Harris residents speak Gaelic at home. This church is set against the mountains of Harris, so you can get all the beautiful pictures that you want. One of the things inside that you'll see is there's several different tombs for clansmen and nobles that would have lived in that area. Clans held on there for quite a long time. And so those people that were prominent in a clan, you know, all of them were Christian. Especially later on, at this point, 15th, 16th century, they would have been mostly Christian. And so that would have been quite an honor for them to be buried in the church. And you can see their tombs. You can see the engravings, the reliefs in the stone. Yeah, the last stop that I would recommend, if you can at all do it, is St. Kilda. So St. Kilda is even more remote. If for some reason Lewis and Harris was not remote enough for you, St. Kilda is a tiny little archipelago about 40 miles west still past Lewis and Harris. And the only real way to get there, there's not a ferry that goes out there. It's in fact uninhabited except for some scientific research, and there is a military base there, but it's uninhabited. So if you want to go out to St. Kilda, you'll have to actually hire a cruise. You'll get a ticket on what they call a cruise, but it's basically a 3-hour boat ride out there on about a 12 to 15 seat boat. You can take a ride out there. And the reason that St. Kilda is so neat and why I absolutely recommend anyone go to it is because of the culture that lived there as well as its natural beauty. So in case for some reason the mountains of Lewis and Harris and Skye were not enough, the dramatic shape of St. Kilda as you get close to it is still unlike anything else in Scotland. And I've never seen anything like it before. And I've been to lots of little islands off the coast of islands before. And this was truly unique. As you've approached St. Kilda, there's basically one large island. It's called Hirta, H-I-R-T-A. And that's the big island of St. Kilda. But what it's most famous for is there was a culture that lived in the St. Kilda archipelago. And it dates back about 2,000 years. But it basically lived independent of everything else until about the last 200 years or so. It was a culture of St. Kildans. They did have communication and trade with Lewis and Harris and some of the other islands, but it was still rare. They basically lived a completely isolated lifestyle. They developed unique architecture. They developed unique ways of farming, ways of life. So it's just totally different. And they pretty much lived that way until the last century. In the early 1900s, the population started to decrease. There was a nasty bout of flu that basically, even though it only killed 10 or 12 people, that kills about 10% of the population. It was always a small population that lived there, but it eventually became untenable. And so the island itself was evacuated in the 1930s. So basically the last permanent residents, the last native St. Kildans left there in the 30s, and they pretty much left their village like it was. There are lots of different unique cultural items that you'll see all over St. Kilda when you get there. But if you get to Hirta, you'll actually see what they call Village Row. Basically, what you'll do is you'll come in on this little boat, and the boat can't actually go all the way up to shore. And so you'll get in a rubber dinghy, for lack of a better term, and that'll get you the rest of the way up to the dock. And so once you're on Hirta, that's the only island that the cruise that we went on actually went on, which is fair. There's not really a way to get to any of the other islands now. But anyway, so once you get there, you'll see the Village Row in front of you, which is a row of all of these old houses, some of them still with their roofs, some of them still with their windows, as people would have left them back in the 30s. And now it's a source of major research. It's a dual UNESCO World Heritage Site. And there are only 35 of them in the world, I think.
When you say dual cultural and...
Yes, and natural beauty.
And natural beauty, okay.
Or natural significance, more accurately.
That's what I couldn't think of the other term, okay.
Natural significance and cultural importance. So it's the only one in the UK. And as I say, there's lots of reasons to go. It's very interesting to learn about the culture of the St. Kildans, those people who lived there. There's lots of stories and legends that exist about both those people that went there, as well as individuals who lived there their whole lives, and then those people who came to, quote unquote, the mainland, which would have been Lewis and Harris, I guess, in this instance, even though that's still quite a ways away from what we would normally think of as the UK. When you get to St. Kilda, you can explore the cultural heritage. That's basically what my mother did. She did a lot of that while I wanted to go up to the tallest point in St. Kilda, which is called Conacher. That's C-O-N-A-C-H-A-I-R, I think. But it's the tallest sea cliffs in the UK. It's these glaring cliffs that are also home to one of the largest seabird colonies in the Atlantic. There's not a single tree on any of St. Kilda. And trees, just in general, are fairly uncommon up here. It's going to be mostly open grasslands, marsh, tundra even, in some cases. So you have a perfect view of everything. Trees aren't in your way. You get to see exactly what the topography of everything looks like. But as you climb, you're able to see swarms of birds flying all over the place. It creates this cacophony of seagull cries and all the different terns and all the different birds that can live there. And so you're surrounded by those birds as you climb. But once you get up to the top, you can get a 360 view of all of the St. Kilda archipelago. And that, at least in my opinion, is one of the best reasons to go out to St. Kilda, just because it's so unique. I was up there and it was actually a pretty nice day, but I could just barely see Lewis and Harris from there. So we had gotten so far out that on anything but the purest, clearest of days, you think that you were the only island in the world. It would have been made perfect sense for the folks that live there to feel that way. Why sail out into the ocean and find nothing? Because as far as they were concerned, especially from a low vantage point, you wouldn't have been able to see it 360 days out of the year.
Interesting.
One of the other big cultural things that I think is kind of interesting is there's a unique architectural thing that exists on St. Kilda, exists nowhere else in the country, exists nowhere else in the world, and they call them cleats. And they're all over St. Kilda. They're these little stone enclosures, I guess. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, maybe 10 feet by 5 feet wide, 3 meters by a meter and a half. And they use them to store stuff.
So it's a beehive-shaped stone structure.
That's a good way to describe it. And so, yeah, they're just these little stone structures. They would barely be big enough to fit a person inside of them. Mm-hmm. But that's where they stored their stuff. So if they were storing milk from their cows, if they were storing wool from their sheep, if they were storing feathers from the birds that they... So basically, one of the things that in the later years of St. Kilda, they actually would harvest the feathers of all of the seabirds, and that they would use it to pay their rent to the UK. You know, so basically you could continue to live there, but we'll need a rent from you, just as is the case with most places. And that's how they paid their tax, is they paid it in feathers, especially during the Victorian age, just because everybody was getting pillows, everybody was getting all these things that needed feathers.
Those buildings look fairly similar if you've been out in Western Ireland to, say, the Dingle Peninsula, you'll see things like that as well. So I think it's a particularly Celtic style to my eye.
I was not aware of that, but yeah, it sounds correct. They call them cleats, which is C-L-E-I-T. One other thing that's kind of neat is if you go along the cliff's edge, there are these little metal posts in there. They're just little metal posts, maybe about a foot and a half high, and they have a little circle in them. That was where a St. Kildan would hook their rope so that they could climb down to the seabird nest, get the egg, get the feathers, whatever they were after, and then come back up. But those hooks still exist. And again, there's no little thing that says, oh, look how cool this is that these were there for thousands of years. Just there it is. You know, you wouldn't even notice it. I knew they were there, and so I was looking for them. But when you get up to the top there, except for there's a radar station that's at the top of Herta that spoils the view, I guess, a little bit. But even then, it's still minimally impactful. You get a beautiful view of all the different islands that make up the archipelago. So as you come down the mountain, as you get back on the boat, depending on which cruise company you use, though, I imagine it's probably pretty similar, you'll have about 4 or 5 hours on St. Kilda, which is more than enough time to get up to the top, get back down, and you'll still have some time if you want to do both. If you want to climb and do some hiking, there's time for that. But if you want to get history too, you can do that also. So there's plenty of time for both. But once you get back on the boat, you don't actually just head straight back to Lewis and Harris, at least with the company we used. They actually took us to what are called the stacks. And there's sea stacks exist all around the world. Just looks like a pillar of rock that comes out of the ocean. You know, so yeah, they're islands, but they're not islands in the traditional sense that you would think you'd come right up to the beach. They're just these enormous rock pillars that jut out of the ocean. And so we stopped by several of those. And what's cool about those is no people really ever lived there. And so they're all birds. You would see literally hundreds of thousands of birds swarming all over these things in this big white cloud. You would look up on the rock, they would be colored white because that birds live there. And so they've got to do their business. There was a scene in one of the Harry Potter movies that utilized those particular sea stacks outside of St. Kilda for one of the shots. I admit, I don't remember which one it was, but you can see these, and it's actually really adds to it, because as if St. Kilda wasn't remote enough, then you have these wild looking islands that you get to go by and you get to see all the wildlife that live there. We saw a seal. Dolphins are not uncommon. Our captain basically had us look for dolphins at some point. But it's just filled with wildlife. And even on St. Kilda itself, there is a population of sheep. They're called Soe sheep. They're actually native to the island of Soe, which is right off of the main island. It's part of the St. Kilda archipelago. The sheep that you would encounter on Lewis and Harris and in Skye and on Rosse, they're owned by somebody. Some farmer owns them so that they can get them for wool or for meat farther down the road. So you would see these Soe sheep all over Herta, the main island of St. Kilda, and they were feral. No one owned them. They basically, they had a little tag on them that so that people could study them because they are a unique species. They just wandered around and ate grass and did everything a sheep does. But they're different from regular sheep. Normally, when we think of sheep, we think of white sheep, but Soe sheep are brown, a chocolate brown almost, like a milk chocolate color. You'll find little tufts of milk chocolate wool all over the ground because, of course, it'll come off in little pieces as any sheep sheds its wool a little bit. So it kind of adds to that strangeness of St. Kilda. Once you've seen those sea stacks, you can head back to Harris, and you pretty much, at least our crews, left about 7 o'clock in the morning. And it took us about an hour and a half to get down there from where we were staying. And so it's a long day. You're going to get there at about 6:45 in the morning. You're going to shove off at 7. You'll get to St. Kilda at 10. You'll leave at 4, get back at 7.
Okay.
It's a full day, definitely, to see St. Kilda. But if you do have the opportunity, it's certainly like nowhere else I've ever been before.
We're going to need to wrap up at this point. This show is going long. Any one last thing we need to know before we start asking our three wrap-up questions?
Sure. The only thing that I would say really about going to the Hebrides is that it's important to be independent. It's important to be resourceful just because you're going to be so isolated. Groceries are uncommon. Restaurants are uncommon. Fill up whenever you see a gas station, petrol station. It's just important to be prepared, be resourceful. One other thing that I might say is that it's really important to take OS maps. So that's ordnance survey maps.
Mm-hmm.
They are invaluable when you're exploring Lewis and Harris and anywhere in the Hebrides, just because, especially those more detailed ones, will show you where every ruin is. They'll show you where every little site is. They'll show you where old crofting villages are to some degree. But they're excellent. They're very detailed. And they're really quite essential if you're going to really explore the islands and not just hit those highlights that most everybody hits. Just be resourceful. Be prepared to not run into a restaurant that day. So make sure you have some food with you.
Okay. Prettiest spot in all the Hebrides?
So for me, it would probably be on top of Herta. So that's Connachar, the tallest peak in St. Kilda, just because you felt so isolated. You were looking around and you couldn't see any islands and you could see the sun glittering off the ocean and it just felt endless. And I'd say that that was probably it, just because also it was so strange. It was so different. You think about those beautiful places you stand in Scotland, and those are great too. But that was, I'd say, really special to me.
Okay. One thing that makes you laugh and say only in the Hebrides?
For me, it was always, you would see so many sheep that you would basically start to have a conversation with them on your walk. You'd be like, hey, how are you doing, Mr. Sheep? You know, you enjoying your grass there? You know, just because you would see many more sheep than you'd see people. And so they just became part of the visit. Those cool travelers that you saw, they may not be people, they may be sheep. So that would definitely be something I would labor for the Hebrides.
Okay. And if you had to summarize the Hebrides in just three words, what three words would you use?
I would use perpetual.
Perpetual. I'm going to have you explain perpetual.
Yeah, perpetual just because it doesn't feel like time matters there.
Okay.
Because you can see ruins in every location. They could be 1,000 years old. They could be 100 years old. And the island's pretty much the same that it has ever since those very first people came out there 5,000 years ago and put up the Callanish stones. It pretty much looks the same. So there were more trees, I guess, but it just feels timeless. It doesn't feel like, oh, that was built in 1550. It was built some time ago. It was built a long time ago. So it just feels, I guess, a little separate from time. So perpetual. Feral would probably be my second word, just because it is so natural.
Okay.
You know, there's just so little impact from people. And so except for the road that you're on, for the most part, you're looking at very old, very natural areas. You're looking at these intimidating mountains that no human would have ever impacted. There's a chance that you would walk across portions of Lewis or Harris if you decided to strike out on your own that had either been walked on in thousands of years or had never been walked on, depending on how you did it. There were certainly some times when I was on Skye, I made my own path across one particular section, and I was pretty sure that no one had ever done what I had done before exactly, just because I was crawling across the mountain here. I was going down this one gully, and it's you and nature, and that's it. And so, feral.
Okay.
And then the last one is probably beautiful.
Okay. Matt, thanks so much. Our guest again has been Matt Higgs. Matt, where can people read more about your travels?
So I write my travels on milesbyfoot.com. I also do Instagram, YouTube under Miles by Foot.
Excellent. And if somebody was looking for your favorite of your mother's books, what would they be looking for?
So probably the one that I helped her do research on, which was My Heart's in the Lowlands.
Okay.
An armchair travel guide to the Lowlands, specifically. Okay. By then, she had written 3 books, but now she's written 5 fiction books that have taken place in the Lowlands, and she knows them like the back of her hand. And so My Heart's in the Lowlands would be my recommendation for anyone that loves Scotland and wants to get a up-close and personal look, especially at the Lowlands.
Excellent. Well, Matt, thanks so much for coming on and sharing with us your love for Hebrides.
Absolutely, Chris. I was so glad to be with you today.
In News of the Community, I heard recently from Michael, who said, just letting you know that your podcast has been an inspiration to seek out opportunities to travel. My wife and I just planned a last-minute trip to Montreal for this coming weekend, and we enjoyed listening to your Quebec episode as preparation. In fact, we thought Ira Bernstein was such a funny guest that we've been listening to his earlier appearances. You have a great format for the podcast and keep a nice balance between loose, free-ranging discussions and more focused questions. Thanks, Mike. Ira was also pleased to hear that as well. I did forward that off to him. Just a piece of curiosity, just in case you are wondering, that is the second most listened to episode on Amateur Traveler. The most listened to episode is an episode on European Russia. Last I checked, the Quebec one had about 42,000 downloads and the European Russian one about 43,600. Now, some of that is luck of the draw. I think that probably happened during one of the times when iTunes was promoting the show. I don't honestly know, but I thought you might be interested in knowing that. And with that, we're going to end this episode of Amateur Traveler. Don't forget the India trip. AmateurTraveler.com/India2017 for more information. It is November of 2017. I hope you can join me. It's still slots available. If you have any questions, send an email to host@AmateurTraveler.com, or better yet, leave a comment in this episode at AmateurTraveler.com. And thanks so much for listening.
I got to see one more cathedral.
This is your moment. Your moment to move forward and make progress. It's time to see where an education can take you. For over 130 years, Strayer University has been at the forefront of change, offering programs that help students like you get ahead and stay ahead, so you can keep striving. Visit strayer.edu to learn more. Strayer University is certified to operate in Virginia by CHEV.